Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Vicki Mazzone. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life. On today's show, Kristen Thiel talks about beer and some very unlikely brew mistresses. M.L. Laurie encourages us to take a breath and let go. Theater director Gemma Whalen discusses Four Last Things, a play about depression and suicide. But first, sociologist Kristen Wilson and I discuss her new book entitled Other's Milk, The Potential of Exceptional Breastfeeding. In this book, she explores new frontiers of breastfeeding and what that can look like for all communities. She's coined a new term, exceptional breastfeeding, to describe breastfeeding experiences outside of what is considered the norm. My guest today on The Politics of Living is Kristen Wilson, chair of the anthropology department at Cabrillo College in Aptos, California. She is the author of Not Trying, Infertility, Childlessness, and Ambivalence. She previously worked as an ethnographer at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta. Her new book, entitled Other's Milk, The Potential of Exceptional Breastfeeding, has very recently been published through Rutgers Press. Welcome to The Politics of Living, Kristen.
Thank you, Vicki. Happy to be here.
You think of breastfeeding in a different way. What's your definition of breastfeeding, and how is it different from the term you use in the title of your book, Exceptional Breastfeeding?
You know, one of the things that I found out through doing this research, I interviewed over 83 families who are doing what I called exceptional breastfeeding eventually, is that in a way it doesn't matter so much how I define it. It's an early finding of the research because so many of the folks that I interviewed define it in different ways. So, for example, some consider nursing a child at the breast or the chest to be breastfeeding, or sometimes called chest feeding, even if there's no milk, and that's sometimes called comfort feeding. Sometimes they will provide milk in formula that is in a bag that they've got around their neck, and there's a tube leading to the nipple, and they'll call that breastfeeding. And then still others describe themselves as breastfeeding if they were giving their children breast milk from a bottle that maybe the parent had pumped or was donated by somebody else who was lactating. And so when breastfeeding doesn't really look like we expect between a mother who gave birth and her infant, it feels exceptional. And so this is kind of an umbrella term to describe these different ways of breastfeeding that people are engaging in order to reach their parenting goals. They want to nurture their children at the breast. They want to nourish them with breast milk, and so that whatever they can do.
You know, in the mid-20th century, it was actively advised to raise babies on formula, not breast milk. That was the prevailing wisdom at the time. That trend seems to have reversed, and breastfeeding in public is now legal across the country. What's the unfinished business of breastfeeding?
Well, I think that it's still, at this point, a really difficult experience for some people. That is because even though it's the accepted norm, more than 80% of people who have a new infant attempt to breastfeed that infant. But when that child is 6 months old, that number starts to dip down drastically. And it's very different depending on one's social status. So folks who have lower incomes are less likely to be able to continue breastfeeding at 6 months, even though that may have well been their intention. In fact, usually it is. Because even though we advocate for breastfeeding, we don't have sufficient social support. So, for example, in many places, you're supposed to be able to pump at work. Well, that doesn't really work in reality for a lot of people who have service jobs. It doesn't work in reality for many teachers or nurses because of the nature of their job, and it really undermines their breastfeeding goals. But the exceptional breastfeeders that I was talking to are people that are even further outside the norm in some ways. These are folks who are inducing lactation. Maybe they didn't give birth to that baby. Perhaps they adopted it or got the baby via surrogacy. People who are not able to, for whatever reason, make enough milk to breastfeed their baby, they get milk from friends. And there's not really a template for the folks who are breastfeeding in these more unusual ways, but there are a lot of those folks. And so what they're doing is they're figuring out ways of kind of creatively reaching their goals without the existing social supports. And so I was interested in talking to them because they're not really waiting for society to catch up, in a sense. They're kind of doing it themselves. And so they provide kind of insight of ways that people can kind of get things done without those supports. But we certainly need to improve our social supports if we really do want to advocate for breastfeeding, which we know is great for the mother, it's great for the baby and the child.
So that's some of the work that you're saying needs to be done. There's more community support, more social support. The perspective of that is always the mother is giving the milk to the infant, but that's not always been the case historically. And sometimes it's been wet nurses or, you know, another animal's milk. You are painting the picture of this community effort where, you know, it takes a village, basically, involving partners, involving siblings, involving any extended family and friends, and sometimes complete strangers. And what do you think that looks like?
A lot of times breastfeeding can feel quite isolating. Folks are kind of doing it in their own home. Maybe they don't feel comfortable doing it in public. It can be a little tricky to get the hang of it, not for everyone, but for a lot of folks. The exceptional breastfeeders that I talk to are folks that really have to reach out to make breastfeeding work. So I ended up interviewing friends who brought breast milk to the hospital for new parents to give to their babies. I talked to milk donors and recipients. In one case, it was a law enforcement community in New England who formed this bucket brigade to get milk from somebody who had extra to somebody who needed it. And so that milk would travel from, you know, a police car to an ambulance to a fire engine and so on, getting to whoever needed it. And I also talked to members of a volunteer collective of Black women in the South who ensured that milk from one low-income woman who had extra milk got to somebody who didn't have enough, and then they facilitated a relationship between those parents. And I also talked to a number of same-sex co-mothers who split the nursing duties, making breastfeeding around the clock easier on everyone. And I bring all of these up because these are broad examples that show us how a community effort can take that experience from being an isolated one into a more socially cohesive one. And I think if everybody had a more social experience with breastfeeding, people would be more supported, more satisfied, everybody be happier.
It sounds like getting back to what we've historically done as humans. As long as we've been around, there's been issues with women not being able to produce milk, so other women would step in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in a lot of places around the world, it is so not a big deal. We really got away from it when formula was thought to be just so scientific and, you know, made in a lab and therefore pure and better. We've, you know, eventually rejected that idea, but there was, you know, a whole generation that was believing that formula was so much better. Now that we're back to breast milk, it's not the same, I think, as it was a long time ago, because we have these little tiny nuclear families. Sometimes we're separated from extended family, and folks are trying to do this on their own. And in the meantime, we have this whole culture of intensive mothering. It started out in the 80s, or really intensified in the 80s, and has been intensifying ever since. This idea that you have to provide the absolute best for your child, and if you don't, then you are a failure. You're a failure as a mother, you're a failure as a woman and as a person. And many, many women extend that to breastfeeding. If breastfeeding doesn't go well for them, they think that they're terrible. I think these exceptional breastfeeders show us, if we have a bit of a broader view of what is successful, maybe folks don't have to be so down on themselves.
A couple generations ago, it was formula, you didn't breastfeed, it was frowned upon, and now the pendulum swung back the other way. So those who don't breastfeed, you write in the book, run the risk of that public scrutiny for being lazy or selfish. And what do you think is the more middle ground for that?
We can't make a judgment about other people's parenting choices because we don't know their experience. So I talked to a number of people who needed to give formula and breast milk to their child because they didn't have enough milk for whatever reason. I talked to people who had suffered sexual trauma earlier in their lives, and for them, breastfeeding was just too uncomfortable, and so they exclusively pumped their milk or maybe used formula. Now, I should mention, for some people who've experienced that sort of trauma, breastfeeding, they told me, was a healing experience for them, and then they could kind of get back to a more comfortable relationship with their own bodies.
There's also gay fathers who want to bond with their babies. There's, as you said, new mothers who can't produce milk, and also, what are the obstacles and what are potential solutions?
One issue here is that there is so much insecurity for everyone about being a good parent, particularly middle-class parents. But you know, parents who have a little bit less social capital are subject to quite a lot of judgment, right, from authorities and so on. And one go-to strategy that we've had, and I feel like politicians have sometimes taken advantage of, is to really point to bad parents to make yourself feel better about difficult decisions. And I would like to see this change, and I see exceptional breastfeeders as showing us a way that that could be done. And not judging other people's choices is an important first step. The next step, I think, is to work collectively to eliminate barriers for parents who are just trying to get their children what they need. And so, yeah, I talked to gay fathers who wanted to be able to give their children breast milk. They're well aware of the benefits of breast milk. And so what some of them have done is gotten donated breast milk in order to give their infants that, you know, high quality nutrition. Another thing that they have done is to hold their baby skin to skin. And this is a very good opportunity for that bonding experience. Sometimes breastfeeding advocates will say, hey, pumped breast milk given to the baby is not the same as breastfeeding. Well, those who need to do that really don't like to hear that story. And there are many other ways to bond with your baby. I mean, there are loads of fathers through time immemorial who've bonded with their babies without breastfeeding them. So I think a middle ground is maybe trying not to judge people for their choices, but to make those choices true choices. So that when people want to breastfeed, and vast majority of people do, that we eliminate all of those obstacles to making that possible. Obstacles like being judgmental in public, obstacles like giving them dirty looks when they're taking a lot of breaks at work, obstacles like not having paid family leave, for instance. There's a number of things that we could do to actually support people in getting breastfeeding to work out for them.
What is your personal interest and or experience with this issue?
I am interested in all manner of family building, and I really like to look at procreative politics as a sociologist and as an ethnographer. I'm particularly interested in the voices of people that get left out. We have a mainstream dialogue about every aspect of parenting and family building, but we often leave out whole swaths of people. So I'm interested in finding out what they have to say about the experience. Kind of from the social margins is where you get change. That's where you get people figuring out new ways of being in our world. When my first son was born, I was kind of expecting to adopt a child. I didn't know when it was going to happen. And when I went to pick him up from the hospital, everything was great. They introduced me to him. I took him home, and I just started lactating. And that experience of being so overwhelmingly happy that I had this new child to take care of caused this physiological reaction of lactation. And this is something that, you know, scientists know happens. And I didn't really know what to do about it. I didn't have any support and any really way of figuring out how to breastfeed it. But even though it's natural, it doesn't come naturally. People are so social. We're social animals, and we need help with certain things, and this is definitely one of them. So then I had a surprise. 1 year later, my child's birth mother had another baby, completely unexpected. I went to the hospital to pick him up, and this time I asked to speak to the lactation consultant, so these experts on breastfeeding, and said, hey, I lactated spontaneously last time. Is there anything that I can do to get breastfeeding to work? And then she provided me with a number of tools for inducing lactation.
So fascinating. That's something I didn't know, that you can have lactation without having been through the pregnancy portion of the program.
That's how same-sex mothers will both breastfeed their baby. One of them can induce lactation. I even talked to trans feminine mothers who breastfed their babies. So you can, be assigned male at birth and still even males have the capacity to induce lactation. Not very many of them do, but it has been documented throughout the world that sometimes if a mother dies when their baby's in infancy, the father might start lactating, and that's happened a number of times.
If breast milk confers immunities to babies, wouldn't the breast milk of multiple people confer more immunities?
It stands to reason, and I joked about this in my own life because I got donor milk for my first son, is that he had immunities to all kinds of things because he got breast milk from such a huge number of women. The breast milk science right now is, if you'll pardon the pun, a little bit in its infancy, but it has been growing a lot. They've been finding out that when somebody breastfeeds their baby actually produces some backwash that is then absorbed by the body of the person who's breastfeeding and causes their body to adjust the composition of the milk. So it's just astonishing research like that. It's hard to say what kind of immune protections they might get from shared milk, because not a ton of research has been done on that. But I do agree that what I've seen with people who are sharing milk is that they really are creating a community. And it's an interesting community because it's sort of a community of convenience, and it's kind of temporary. The relationships are oftentimes pretty deep and emotional, but then they go away. When the breastfeeding journey is over, that relationship might well dissipate.
You know, you mentioned earlier about your own experience with a lactation consultant, and I'm wondering how widespread lactation consultants are and how possibly they could be made more readily available to folks who don't have a lot of income or resources.
Wow, that is such a good question. So most of the hospitals do have a relationship with lactation consultant. The larger hospitals will have some on staff. Baby-friendly hospitals usually have lactation consultants on hand. Midwives typically have close relationships with lactation consultants. And so they are available for those. Sometimes if you need more help than might be provided very soon after the birth, not everybody has the income to hire a private lactation consultant. And so there are some other groups. There's in California, there's something called the Nursing Council, which provides free lactation consulting in the home and over the phone. Of course, La Leche League is been around since the 1950s, and most communities have La Leche League meetings, or you can call La Leche League to get advice about breastfeeding. And some people have had quite a lot of success with that. It varies. I think folks who are doing breastfeeding in some more unusual ways, inducing lactation or maybe sharing their milk, or maybe having some trouble with their milk supply or getting breastfeeding going, there are a lot of resources on the internet to get them started. I talked to a number of people who would find communities online, but then those would quickly lead to in-person meetings. And in-person meetings definitely, I think, helps a lot in terms of just really being able to see being able to troubleshoot, you know, problems with breastfeeding.
Data concluding that either breastfeeding or formula are clearly superior is lacking, I'm assuming, because you've done some research. You cautioned use of any definitive outcomes for either one of these, and why?
You know, there's more research really every day about the composition of breast milk. There was a little bit of a cottage industry in the scholarly community talking about how the claims about breast milk and breastfeeding were a bit overblown, that the data were not as strong as maybe the ad campaign suggested they were. I do think that what's been happening is that more and more research has been done on breast milk, and it is shown to be quite a healthful substance. And then there's more of a range, I think, with formula. But the thing is that sometimes formula is what parents need.
In the interview you just heard, author Kristen Wilson mentioned that mothers often stop breastfeeding their babies at around 9 months. Some people breastfeed their children for several years. What do you think is a good time limit? Let us know your thoughts and comments by visiting our webpage at kboo.fm, Politics of Living, Episode 24, or emailing the show at tpol@kboo.org. The complete interview with author Kristen Wilson is posted on our show page at kboo.fm/program/politics-living. Korib Theater director Gemma Whalen talks with me about the play Four Last Things, written by Irish playwright Lisa Tierney Keough. It's a sensitive play about a young woman who's living in rural Ireland, struggling with depression and unable to communicate her despair. Those around her think that she's got everything to live for, except for her dog, who sees her pain but is unable to communicate with her. My guest today on The Politics of Living is Gemma Whalen. She's the artistic director of Korib Theater in Portland, Oregon. She's a founding artistic director, and she's the director of the play Four Last Things, written by Lisa Tierney Keough. Tierney Keough won the Irish Times Electric Supply Board Irish Theater Awards in 2002, and Four Last Things was originally staged at the Dublin Fringe in 2009. The play is being held here in Portland, Oregon. It's currently in rehearsals, and it opens on February 1st and runs through February 24th. Welcome, Gemma, to The Politics of Living.
Thank you, Vicki.
Four Last Things, the play, is the story of an Irish woman named Jane who has dropped out of college, is living in rural Ireland with her father and the family dog. She's struggling with depression. So much has been reported and studied about depression and mental health in recent times. What does this play present about depression that is different?
Well, one of the Irish setting, of course, and the rural setting is very specific to Ireland. However, I think it, just like all of our Korib plays, it reflects on issues that are front and center here in the United States. She comes from deep in the country in Ireland, deeply rural Ireland. It's actually 3 hours' drive from Dublin. It's quite far away, and she comes home every weekend, partly because there's this pull from her family that makes it really hard for her in Dublin, where she actually feels at home. I think, you know, Ireland is a country that has undergone huge social changes, social cultural changes in the last few decades. We've made amazing strides in terms of women's rights, choice, LGBTQ rights, and so on. And, you know, the exposition of abuses that have gone on for especially a lot of the 20th, 19th, 20th century. and people are being held accountable for those. But it feels to me like mental illness is one of those, it's like a last holdout. You know, there's still a stigma attached and a huge amount of basically ignorance and lack of information about advances that people have made. And I have found in, you know, looking at this play and working on it, that the Irish mental health system is still, it's way back, it's like back in the dark ages. It's almost like a last holdout, right, in terms of a lack of understanding and a lack of growth in terms of people's awareness. I think, you know, the fact that it examines it from a rural perspective, and in Ireland, like her father is, he knows the land, her mother as well. They know the land and they're entrenched, and they also are entrenched to some extent in their old values and can't accept the fact that their daughter has mental health problems. And some of that also is just an inability to communicate. A lot of it is an inability to extend themselves, to, you know, use language they're not used to using. They're uncomfortable, they're ashamed of her.
Right, because it's probably seen as not being strong or not being normal.
Exactly. And there's some wonderful, it's a very, by the way, beautifully written, very sensitive play, very poetical in many ways. You know, one of the things that Jane herself talks about is she reports what she hears neighbors saying or even imagines they're saying. And one of the things, well, is, you know, what's wrong with her, basically? She's you know, she's this beautiful young girl. She's got everything going for her, right? She's in school. It sounds like she's probably in medical school, from what we gather from the script. So she's clever, and she's in college. So they say things like, and she's a lovely, you know, she's a gorgeous young girl with everything going for her. What has she got to be so upset about? They completely miss the point, of course, that, you know, there's an illness. And in this case, it's mitigated by factors which, you know, seem to me, like coming from Ireland, to be like very Irish in terms of rooted in this, you know, don't talk about the things that are really important. Talk about everything else, right? Because we're famous for being great talkers, the Irish are. Then when it comes down to talking about really intimate things or issues like this that are just hard. And then, of course, I realized that's not just a provenance of the Irish. Like, we don't have the exclusive dibs on inability to communicate.
No, you certainly don't.
Yes, and also country too. It's not like we're immune here by any means, and even parts that we think are liberal. There are people who are very liberal-minded in all sorts of other areas, and they still can't quite grasp this, you know, frontier somehow. You know, when I had read this play, Four Last Things, and it was, you know, mulling around in my head, and then I started to read about, in terms of before I'd even chosen the season, and read about actually a big increase in suicide in this country. This is meaning the United States, right? It's one of the leading causes of death between the ages of like 14 and 24. You know, young people the same age as the young woman.
And yes, and that's very heartbreaking. And I'm glad you're mentioning this, because my next question was, other than being Irish and understanding the culture and the mindset, what drew you to this play? How did you get involved?
I heard about the playwright, Lisa Tiernikio, initially in relation to her advocacy in Ireland for a group called Waking the Feminists. It was really a movement that was established in Ireland just a few years ago. It came about in response to our national theater, the Abbey Theater, announcing their season. And yet again, it was a season, like there were 10 plays, 9 of them were written by men, and one of them written by a woman was actually based on a monologue by a man, by Sean O'Casey, and it was a play for children. So for some reason, that was a tipping point, because this has been going on for, you know, a century. The theater was founded in the early 1900s, and it's our national theater, so it's supposed to present national playwrights. And there had only been like a couple of women in all of those years, 100 years. Well, they somehow broke through, those women, but Marina Carr is one of them. She would probably be the one that's most well known right now. But apart from that, it didn't happen. So this movement started in protest, and it actually changed things radically. It changed the whole theater culture in Ireland and has started to change, you know, the gender balance, which was the whole point. It's still going strong. But Lisa was one of the people And I subsequently heard her say that she did this so that younger women might have a chance. And interestingly enough, just about a month and a half ago, the Abbey announced their coming up season, and she her play is actually being performed in the Abbey Theatre next season. Now, the balance has shifted for the last few seasons. They have a committee that looks at gender equity and I think equity in general, and it's happened throughout Ireland. Now, Ireland is a very small country, and of course, we have the same movement here, and then, you know, outgrowths of Me Too and so on, where there have been shifts. But I think looking at what happened in Ireland as a, you know, sort of an experiment, because it's a much smaller population, it's amazing. To me, it's amazing that these changes can happen, and you really see the impact of it. So I read, I wrote to Lisa. I found her email and asked her that I'd like to read some for work, and she sent me this play. So I just was really affected by the play. And then, as I mentioned to you before, some of the other factors that, you know, in our present history, the last few years with the big divide in our country, it has also caused a lot more tension and depression, actually, in the population. So that's what made me feel like this is the time to do this play. Okay. I also love, the other thing I loved about the play is that there's a dog in the play.
There's a talking dog. I think that's fabulous.
Indeed.
And what does he represent?
So the dog is, the dog's name is Bob, and I actually have cast a woman in the role. So it's played by, he's still Bob, but played by Jacqueline Maddox, wonderful local actress. And so Bob is really Jane's dog. Jane is the young woman, the college student, a dog that she found, you know, in the ditch and sort of became her dog. The dog feels, intuits what is going on with Jane, knows there's something wrong, there's something off kilter, smells the fear coming from the humans, and actually even the other animals on the farm are unsettled. There's an unsettled feeling. But, of course, can't speak, right? So it's ironic, is this animal, and, you know, we all know how intuitive animals can be and how comforting they can be to people, to us. And so the Bob articulates all of these feelings and would do anything, really sort of sees himself as a parent to Jane. And if only he could speak, would be able to give her some of the solace that she needs, some of the community, because she craves communication. She wants someone to talk to her, but people are only, they're talking about her. They're talking around her. And her own father, who is the other character in the play, Brendan, he's definitely a very kind and thoughtful and feeling person. And he has all of these thoughts, but they're locked inside of him. He can't speak them. He can't bring himself to speak even the most basic things in terms of communicating with his daughter. So he's somewhere along the way, he used to communicate very well with her when she was young, when she was a little kid. And he is the one, actually, that if he could talk, he could at least help her. You know, he's not going to solve all of her problems instantly by communicating, but she craves this. They're very strongly connected, she and her father. So there's definitely a bond between them. But he's inarticulate. He just can't get the words out, you know, and he spent a lot of his time on his own, or at least, you know, they have a son as well, and he's married, there's a wife. Ironically, the mother talks all the time, nonstop. But not about anything important, right? She's referred to quite a bit by the others. So she's a huge talker, but she doesn't listen. You know, a lot of it is about...
Or it's not a deep conversation with her, yeah.
It's not a deep conversation. She's afraid of the deep conversation. She's afraid because she wouldn't know how to handle the information. If she ever asked Jane, what are you feeling? Nobody asks her that question.
Which is, I think what gets back to what you said earlier about people are uncomfortable with that conversation. The Irish are great talkers. No one's having that conversation because it's uncomfortable, it's intimate, it's scary.
It's scary, exactly. And, you know, we've had so-called mental hospitals in Ireland for a long time, and it was a place to put people where you didn't understand what was wrong with them.
That happened over here too, yes.
Yeah, you know, including like women when they hit menopause, right? It's like, well, what's wrong? Do they just go mad or something? Yeah, that's why don't we lock them up? The human brain is very complicated. And it's, but the thing about today is there's so much research that has been done. We have, we still don't, there's so much we don't understand and maybe never will, but there has been a massive amount of research and advances, and we know so much more about its possibilities and how, you know, pliant and resilient it can be, and how much change we all can make, regardless of age or where we are or of our backgrounds and what we suffered or trauma. The sad thing is we're here we are. It's like 2019, and we have this research, but why hasn't it, people don't know about it or are afraid to find out about it, or it hasn't been disseminated amongst the general population. So then we often have these situations that sadly can end in tragedy that are avoidable, you know, are potentially avoidable. There's no easy solution, and every case is going to be different. You know, it's not black and white. More education and increasing the ability to actually, I mean, that's my hope with doing with the, you know, with the play, is that people will see the play and it's like, I need to open my mouth. I need to reach out. If I just extended myself this little bit more, like, might it make a difference in this situation?
I do think that most people, when they're reaching out for something, they want someone to acknowledge their pain. They want someone to say, I see you. I see your pain. I see why you're feeling that way.
I really do. Yeah. I mean, I think we all have a need to be seen, you know, and recognized for who we are. And when someone is so deeply submerged and in such pain, there's a need, there's a craving. And this is certainly true of the character in our play. And then partly because of what's going on in her brain, and her needs are not being met in her immediate family and in society. She at several times says, I want to feel that I'm worth something. You know, that a life is worth something, that I can see possibility, that there's hope for the future. And I think in acknowledgement of that, she, you know, has lines like, why don't they speak to me? Why don't they ask me, why am I still here? You know, mm-hmm. Why am I not going back to Dublin? They don't even ask that, even though, you know, the play begins with her having spent a week in a mental institution in Dublin. But she comes home.
No one talks about it,
and she clearly, you know, this is not a play that like maps out every single second, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems pretty clear. It's pretty easy to deduce that she was sent home with no supports. She seems to have pills, but there's no therapy. There's no professional support, and clearly the family is not equipped to deal with or extend the support that's needed. So she has a brother and mother and a father who won't talk to her about anything meaningful. And then her dog, who knows actually what needs to be done and knows that she needs this sort of nurturing and acknowledgement, and of course is limited.
The title of the play is Four Last Things. Mm-hmm. What are the four last things, or do they differ from person to person?
It's really interesting that the play itself never actually refers to the four last things. The four last things are actually, they're part of like a religious doctrine referring to the four last stages of the soul. They are death, judgment, heaven, and hell. You know, that said, there is almost no reference to religion in the play at all. They go to Mass. The Catholic, the family, father and mother go to Mass on Sunday. So, you know, there's a fleeting reference, but there's no, it's not like this is infused with religion or religious thought or anything. And in fact, it's, you know, considering the topic of the play and what it's about, there isn't any sense of looking to religion for solace or guidance or anything. It's more in a broader sense of, basically, taking a reckoning is looking at your life and, you know, what it adds up to, trying to decide if it, you know, what its meaning is and purpose and so on. there's a, you know, there are themes of that like running through the show, and especially with Jane as she gets more and more into herself, trying to sum up what it is that she is going through, what she feels, and, you know, why she's taking the course that she's taking.
So there are some audience enrichment events around the play that will be happening through the course of the run, and the run, of course, from the play is February 1st through the 24th at the New Expressive Works at 810 Southeast Belmont Street. And would you like to add some information about these enrichment events?
The play runs, you know, Thursday through Saturday, and we have a Sunday matinee. And we have actually a lot of events set up, a lot more than we ever had in the past for this particular play. And that's partly because I felt support was needed around the play. One of the organizations I was working with was NAMI, National Association of Mental Health. NAMI has been the local branch here, has been really supportive. We will have materials in the lobby. And for almost every single performance, we will have somebody at a table. So somebody who is connected with NAMI, who is there to answer questions, who's there to give support to anybody who might need more information or might need to know, who do I go to if I need help? We have two talkbacks that we have specifically set are sponsored by NAMI. So they're a bit, that's one of the big, one of our big partners. We're having an event for the Oregon Humane Society. To me, that's an important part of the conversation, is how important animals are and how much support actually they give people. The playwright is coming over from Ireland. We're really thrilled. She's going to be here for the second weekend of the show. We have a special event on the evening of Sunday, February 10th at 7 p.m. in the theater space. And Lisa Tiernicchio will be there. And Jane Vogel, who is the founder of AGE, which is an organization that promotes gender equity here, right here in Portland. Also Sarah Jane Hardy of Northwest Children's Theater. She's on the panel, and I'll be on the panel as well. That will be, it'll really be a conversation with Lisa leading the conversation, but with all of us talking, and then followed by a reception. I'm hoping lots of people will, you know, take the opportunity to come to see the play, and then if possible, come to the Waking the Feminist one too, because I think it could be, well, it's, you know, we need that sort of help too. So it's something we continue to work on here in the United States and in Portland specifically in terms of equity and inclusion.
I love the fact that you are looping in the National Alliance for Mental Illness as a support for this, and also the Humane Society.
I happen to have several artist friends who went on and trained recently as therapists, actually. I have a panel with several of therapists / artists, as I call them, to get, you know, to get that perspective.
Four Last Things will be performed at New Expressive Works, 810 Southeast Belmont Street, Portland, Oregon, from February 1st to the 24th. Links to the Corrib Theater will be on our webpage at kboo.fm. Search for The Politics of Living. The complete interview with theater director Gemma Whalen is posted on our main show webpage. Go to kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living. The She-Ra Solution is a monthly biography of women past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Teresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published June 16, 2016 in The Atlantic. Today, Kristen talks about a very recent development in beer brewing, breweries owned by Native American women. Until 2016, there wasn't such a thing anywhere in the country. With hope and a lot of hard work, these founding mothers will start a fermentation revolution. Here's Kristen Thiel.
Last month, Deb Holland and Charisse Davids became the first Native American women sworn into U.S. Congress. I loved what Sarah Sunshine Manning said of this in an opinion piece for the Washington Post. Quote, "This is about more than a marginalized group seeing its reflection in Congress. For Native American women, this is also about asserting their ancestral right to leadership." This month, the She-Ra Solution approaches rightful representation and leadership from a lighter, but still important angle, Native American women in beer making. Brewing in the United States is often caught up in white male patriotism. After all, Sam Adams was not just a brewer, but a founding father. But long before anyone dreamed of toasting the 4th of July with a Boston Lager, the indigenous peoples of this land were brewing beer. Colonization and its legacy directly affected Native Americans and their brewing practices. Look all the way back to the beginning of white influence in North America. Under the stress of land seizure and direct attacks, many indigenous peoples simply could not continue brewing for ceremonial purposes. Follow this forward to 20th century Prohibition. When that ended for most Americans in 1933, Native Americans remained prohibited from buying or consuming alcohol until 1953. Throughout these many, many years of white colonization, alcoholism has been a blight in Native territories, and indigenous peoples have struggled against the stereotype of being alcoholics. Now, four Native American women are reclaiming their truth. From North Carolina, Morgan Owl Crisp told October, a beer magazine, that founding Seven Clans Brewing feels like a, quote, act of sovereignty. By taking control of the narrative, they can change it. Shyla Shepherd told the magazine of her New Mexico-based Bow and Arrow Brewing Company, quote, I was excited to reclaim some of those things that were authentic to us and our experience. In 2016, Shepherd, a member of the three affiliated tribes, and Missy Begay, a member of the Dene Nation, co-founded Bow and Arrow, the first brewery in the United States to be owned by Native American women. The two met at Stanford University when Shepherd was an economics major. She went on to become a social impact investor before opening Bow and Arrow, and Begay was pre-med. She went on to complete medical school. They are also romantic partners, and their beer hall in Albuquerque is an inclusive third place for people of all orientations and genders. Shepherd told The Guardian newspaper that, quote, women have stopped us and said, thank you for creating this space. After Shepherd and Begay started their brewery, Owl Crisp and Colette Coggins, along with Travis Crisp and Frank Bonomo, in lesser roles than the two women, founded Seven Clans in North Carolina. Owl Crisp and Coggins are both members of EBCI, the Eastern Band of Cherokee. In the Cherokee tradition, women are responsible for fermenting beverages. Pre-colonial indigenous brewers used corn to produce low-alcohol beer. Seven Clans' first beer was dedicated to Selu, the Cherokee goddess of corn. Bow and Arrow Brewing has used everything from Navajo tea to sumac berries to, yes, blue corn, to make beer. Looking ahead, Shepherd and Begay hope to use entirely locally sourced ingredients, including local yeast, in their beer. The stronger Bow and Arrow becomes, the stronger Shepherd and Begay hope to make the greater population of Native American women. 150 people attended their kickoff of the first annual Native Women's Business Summit this last year. Shepherd told The Guardian, quote, to pack a room with Native women business people was amazing. I feel like there is becoming this critical mass where there is more conversation and dialogue and desire to support each other. To be a part of that is something we are very proud of. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with the She-Ra Solution. ML Laurie not only encourages us to stop and think for a minute, but she also advises us to take a breath and just let go. And also, how awareness can help us shed our false cultural myths. Here's ML Laurie with Let's Stop for a Minute.
So let's stop for a minute. Let's think about this. In my last reflection, we touched on some heavy subjects. We discussed our faulty software programs, our ways of thinking, our low self-esteem, and going against heavy false cultural myths, which are the learned software programs that we have been taught are the truth about our world and which are at the core of our functioning in the world. The main faulty myths or faulty software programs discussed were about being able to find lasting happiness through things outside of ourselves and the idea that we think we are alone in many of our insecurities and feelings. I left you with several questions. How do we begin to look inside of ourselves for happiness? Can we learn to do this quickly? And why does it matter that we are not alone in our feelings, thoughts, and insecurities in dealing with ourselves and the world? So let's stop for a minute. Let's take a breath. Let me introduce you to an important take a breath concept, the practice of letting go. So think about this. Do you think we can just let go of our insecurities, low self-esteem, faulty software programs, or whatever might be interfering with our happiness? What would happiness be like for us if we just let go of these things? Yes, it is possible to let go of all the things that interfere with our happiness. Some parts of letting go can be quick. Others take work and time. But the key, always the key, is becoming aware. As I presented before, we cannot let go of anything that we don't know is there. Becoming aware of our faulty programs or thinking is essential to this practice of letting go. So how do we begin to look inside of ourselves for our happiness? We often become frightened and feel insecure about looking inside of ourselves. Sometimes this comes from having experienced a heavy trauma, but more often it comes from low self-esteem brought on by the learned false cultural myth of looking outside of ourselves for validation. We all have experienced some type of rejection. If we have believed the cultural myth that our sense of self is dependent on what others think about us, then of course we have had our self-esteem stepped on. The reality is, though, that the false cultural myth of looking outside of ourselves for validation and thereby happiness cannot be successful for any length of time. So think about this. If what others see when they look at us is true, then why do different people think different things about us? After all, if we are definitely what others think about us, wouldn't everyone see the same thing and think the same thing about us? Think about it. We each come from our own unique software programs, our ways of thinking that have been put in our mind. So we each see things outside of ourselves from our own unique perspective. This is why no two people can see the exact same thing. They might agree on some things, but the reality is that it is impossible for any of us to see the exact same thing because we each have our own unique perspective, which comes from our learned software programs, our learned ways of thinking about and judging things. From this understanding of reality, I hope we each can learn to be kind to ourselves as we work to take back our controls and power, that we no longer allow ourselves to be ruled by faulty cultural myths, that we no longer believe we are what others see or say we are, and that we learn to understand that each of us is a unique human being and that this in itself makes each of us special. It is possible to quickly let go of the easy-to-see software programs. For example, as a child, I always thought I hated spinach, but as an adult, I tried it and loved it. Somehow, somewhere as a child, I developed the faulty thinking that I hated spinach. It was easy to let go of this faulty thinking because it was easy to see. It just wasn't true. So some of our software programs are easy to see, but many of the software programs that we operate from that influence our thinking about and views of things are deep and have been there for a really long time. So again, the way to get at these is to pay attention. Don't just act without thinking. Pay attention to what comes up in your mind and just watch it. It can become fun and almost like a puzzle when we start to see the mystery that is us and the software programs that make up our mind. We will find there are many of our software programs that we actually want to keep. So let's stop for a minute and think about all of this. What are the ways we can learn to let go? Why is letting go a good thing? Why might we have trouble letting go? Why would we even want to? Think about it. I'm ML Laurie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests and our contributors, Kristen Wilson, Gemma Whalen, Kristen Thiel, and ML Laurie. And also thanks to our web manager and creator, Denise Kowalczyk. Visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, episode 24, to find links about today's topics and guests. All feedback, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to tpol@kboo.org. If you'd like to be a guest or a contributor on The Politics of Living, please email tpol@kboo.org. We're going to end this episode with a song performed by contributor Deborah Giannini. It's entitled "Oh My Star" by composer Anais Mitchell. Thanks for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Vicki Mazzone.
I'm Deborah Giannini. I'm presenting the soundbite this month, covering a song once again by Anais Mitchell. I guess there's a big reason why I'd like you to know a little bit about her work. It's an inspiring song called "Oh My Star." But later this year, she's got a big work that'll be hitting Broadway called Hadestown, another great collection of sounds, songs, stories from the myth of Orpheus. Oh My Star is a song that Aeneas thinks of as a country song. I think it's just a great inspiration for the new year. I can't keep up with you no more. I can't catch you, but I can hold you down. I can't catch you. Oh, my star, don't fail me now. You down. I can't hold you. Oh, my heart, don't fail me now. I know where my satisfaction lies. It's there beyond the down. I want to hold you. Oh, my soul, don't fail me now. That was a song by Aeneas Mitchell, Oh, My Star. We're highlighting her this month because she'll be debuting her Broadway musical, Hadestown, The Myth of Orpheus. Thanks for listening.